Welcome to a very special presentation of the novel A Really Good Day by James Hosek. On its surface, it's a story about a remarkable round of golf. But if you're not a golfer, if you quickly change the channel, if you accidentally come upon a tournament on TV, I encourage you to listen anyway. It's a story about family and friendship. It's a story about redemption and second chances. It's a story about promises made and promises kept. It's a story about once-in-a-lifetime experiences. But most of all, it is one man's love letter to his family. That man was my brother, the author, James Hosek. Aside from being an amazing veterinarian, woodworker, gardener, husband, father, brother, son, and friend, he was a writer. Writers are often told to write what they know. And in this, his first book, he did that in more ways than I can count. It will make you laugh. It will make you cry. And it will make you stand up and cheer. So sit back and enjoy as Jim takes you on a fun, entertaining journey through 18 holes of golf and one man's really good day. Chapter 16. 11th hole. Andrew received his driver from Eric Peters and stepped up to the tee and analyzed the fairway. Water to the left, sand traps along the right, with some low hills beyond them. It was a fairly long hole, and a good drive would leave him 2 strokes from the green, but with the hazards edging the fairway, this was not the time to try for a 300-yard drive. A slight fade to the left would be appropriate.
"Whenever you're ready, Mr. Patterson," announced the red-jacketed official.
Another official next to him raised his hand to silence the crowd. Soon they were all quiet. Now was the time to play a little psychological warfare. Scott Hanover had ended up in the water on the last water hole he had played. Andrew hoped he could either draw him into the water on this hole or push him into the sand on the other side. He grinned as he thought of what was going through Hanover's head. He placed his ball down and then looked right at Hanover. The young man was smiling, apparently happy with his lucky par on the last hole.
"Watch this," thought Andrew.
He whacked the ball and followed it into the air. It soared over the edge of the water hazard before finding the middle of the fairway and bounced slightly to the left, rolling to a stop 230 yards down the fairway.
"Excellent," thought Andrew.
He walked towards Hanover and met his eyes.
"Good drive," said Scott.
Andrew simply nodded and took his place down from where Scott was standing.
"Nice guy," whispered Paul.
"I can hit it farther than that," answered Scott.
"Yeah, that's what he wants."
"What?"
"He's playing you, Scott.
He wants you to make a mistake. He needs you to make mistakes for him to win."
Paul continued quietly.
"Just keep it to the right. Stay away from the water."
"Yeah, I sure could use a good quack."
Paul nodded in agreement and handed Scott his driver. As Scott walked to the tee box, Paul headed for the golf cart parked 10 yards down the fairway. He glanced at the starter as he passed him. It was the same annoyed official who had quashed the quacking on the 8th hole. Whether or not the lack of a quack was the reason that Scott ended up in the water, he didn't know for sure. But if there was something he could do about it, he would.
"Mr. Bateman?" he asked.
He remembered the tournament chairman from their earlier meeting after the 9th hole. Carl Bateman turned to face him.
"Yes?"
he answered. His tone was gruff, and he seemed slightly annoyed to be bothered at this moment, as if he was the one approaching the tee.
Scott and I have a little tradition on water holes, and the official there seems to be bothered by it. But I really don't think it's that big a deal."
"Bothered by what?"
"Well, I usually will quack whenever Scott has to tee off near water. Back on the 8th hole, he stopped us from doing it. I guess because it annoyed him."
"Well, I don't think it's appropriate," started Bateman. "Let the boy quack, Bateman.
urged the other man on the cart.
What? Responded Carl. He's the duck, for goodness sakes, he growled. It'll be good for the television coverage.
Carl thought for a moment, then yelled,
Henderson!
The red-jacketed man standing near the tee turned to the sound of Bateman's voice. Bateman beckoned him with a finger. Henderson seemed startled to be called by the head of the tournament association.
Wait here, he said to Scott, who was just starting his practice swings.
He jogged as quickly as his large frame would let him. Despite the cool weather, he found himself sweating, either from the extra exertion or a sense of apprehension. David Henderson was soon standing next to Carl Bateman in his cart.
Yes, sir,
he asked.
This fellow says you banned him from quacking on the tee.
It was disturbing the other golfers, he answered.
It was not, said Paul. He quickly grew angry at the official's lie. They were quacking with me halfway through the front nine. Heck, even the camerawoman from USA Sports was doing it, and most of the onlookers. It only bothered him.
He pointed at the logo emblazoned on the left breast pocket of the man's red jacket.
It was a very distracting practice, Henderson said, defending himself. Certainly not against the rules, pointed out Bateman. He can quack, he ordered.
Yes, sir, muttered Henderson.
He walked back to his position, this time wiping his face with a handkerchief he had pulled from the rear pocket of his slacks.
Paul searched for Ellie and found her. She looked confused. He simply mouthed quack, and she smiled in acknowledgement.
He turned to find Sarah and her friends, walked over, and quickly explained what they should do.
Scott was standing on the tee, confused.
On three, shouted Paul. One, two, three. Scott smiled with realization and appreciation at what Paul had just done.
Quack,
bleated out Paul, Ellie, Sarah, the girls, and about a dozen other people who had caught on to what was happening. Ellie listened through her headphones as Jason explained what had just happened.
And that is why he is called the duck. Apparently he's never seen a water hazard he hasn't liked. Let's see if his little good luck ritual can help him negotiate the water he will find on both sides of the hole.
Andrew Patterson stood slack-jawed at the display. He had never seen anything like it in any tournament he had ever played. This was insane. A quack? What was going on?
They call him the duck, whispered Eric.
Scott stepped up confidently to the ball. He looked at Andrew's ball sitting on the course and then hit his own. It sailed up and over the water, almost a perfect duplication of Andrew's shot, but it rolled another 20 yards past the first golfer's drive. The crowd erupted into applause and quacks at Hanover's accomplishment. Andrew was amazed at the shot and the reaction. How did a noisy, distracting quack allow Hanover to hit a shot like that? He was even in a good position for his second shot. This wasn't right. The guy did have some luck, and it was a factor that Andrew was finding difficult to deal with.
That was amazing, commented Joe Calkin to Ted Lang. I think Patterson was pretty surprised by that shot.
I think he's in for some more surprises, added Ted. The golfers led the crowd down the fairway. Paul leaned over to Scott.
I thought you used up your quota of amazing shots.
Apparently not, answered Scott. He looked at his friend.
Thanks, he added.
What? Oh, well, it wasn't really fair, so I thought I'd try. Think it made a difference?
Scott just pointed ahead of them to the white ball lying on the fairway.
Right, agreed Paul. Andrew found himself in position to hit ahead of Hanover again. At least there was that. There was no way this guy would get a second shot off like that. Andrew was 310 yards from the green. He wanted to be about 120 for his third shot, and Eric wordlessly handed him the 7-iron. He'd once again be playing the left side of the fairway. The flag was on the right side of the green, but approaching from the left gave him more area to play with. He walked up to his ball. It lay next to a leaf. He picked it up, and the ball rocked away, and then fell back. He breathed with relief. Had the ball not returned to its original position, he would have had to take a penalty. He had never taken a penalty for something like that. Why was he so careless? He knew it wasn't Hanover putting pressure on him. That was ridiculous. Perhaps it was the distraction of the brief interview with that reporter, Lucy Pendle. In any case, he made a mental note to be more careful. All he needed at this point was to make a stupid mistake. He lined up his shot, and once again the ball sailed high, landing and rolling a short distance to the exact spot he had aimed. He smiled. Nothing less than perfection, he noted. "He sure can hit it straight," commented Paul. "Well, assuming I don't, where do I go?" "Water to the right, stay left, like Patterson. You have 290 yards to the green."
"Three wood?" asked Scott.
"That would leave you a nice chip. Your chipping has been excellent today. Can you keep it straight?" "Well, considering I usually slice a little with the club, if I aim left, I'll be okay." "Then go for it."
Paul pulled the club out of the bag, removing the stuffed elephant cover from the wood. Scott drew his imaginary line from the left side of the fairway to the ball, and then placed the head of the club about a yard behind the ball in that line. He stepped around the club to place his feet parallel to that line. Andrew chuckled at Hanover's little dance with the club. The guy couldn't even line up a shot. Scott set the club short of the ball and took two practice swings, both cutting a swath of grass from the ground. He stepped up and took his backswing. As he brought it down, he saw the twisting of the club head as it struck the ball. It soared up from its lie in the grass, and for 150 yards sailed straight. Then its spin overtook airspeed, and it began to turn. It bounced near the middle of the fairway, but it had picked up considerable motion to the right. It landed halfway to the water and rolled, disappearing into the tall grass next to the water hazard, about 70 yards from the hole.
"Rats," Scott said. "Do you think it went in?"
"Probably," answered Paul.
"Well, on and four and one putt, eh?"
"Good plan," agreed Paul. Ellie's camera lost the ball in the tall grass. She listened to see if another camera angle had caught it. Jason's voice once again crackled to life. "Difficult to tell from this angle where that ball ended up," he said. "A penalty here could narrow Hanover's lead by another stroke or eliminate it altogether." Bob's voice cut in on her headset and instructed her to work her way along the right side of the fairway to see if she could spot the ball. In the meantime, Alf Redding followed Patterson to his position on the fairway. Andrew could barely contain his glee. This was going to be easier than he thought. How could someone with that little control of his swing have gotten this far? He had seen the golfer line up to hit near his ball and watched as he dropped his shoulder too soon, causing the club head to twist. And what was he doing hitting a 3-wood from 290 yards? He was asking for trouble, especially on such a narrow fairway. The crowd was following Andrew to his ball. Eric handed him the pitching wedge, and he looked towards the green. Easy par and perhaps another chance at birdie. He lined up and whacked the ball. It soared up straight at the pin, then landed with a thunk and rolled back a few inches. It ended up 3 yards from the hole, pretty much in the center of the green. This particular green was flat, and he nodded in approval. To his right, Hanover and his caddy were walking slowly to the water hazard lining that side of the fairway. Nearby was a camera woman scanning the ground with her lens. There were no onlookers on that side due to the presence of the water, and a murmur could be heard circulating through the crowd, like a secret being passed in a classroom. Paul and Scott approached the edge of the water. Below the surface, several balls could be seen.
"I don't see one with a duck," Paul said.
"It must have gone in right around here," added Scott.
"Hey," Ellie called from a couple feet away. "I think I got it," she announced.
"You see it?"
Scott walked over to the edge of the water where the camera woman was standing. "Not in the water," she said. "There." She pointed with her left hand to a clump of tall grass at the edge of the water. Hanging over the pond and nestled in the blades of the long grass was a tiny yellow duck sitting on a white ball.
"Wow," said Paul. "That's hard to do."
Jason Bernard stared at the image on the monitor.
"That is either incredibly lucky or incredibly unlucky, depending on how you look at it. He didn't lose the ball in the water, but how he's going to hit it from there is going to be quite a trick."
Alf raced up to where Hanover, his caddy, and Ellie were standing. He looked at the ball nestled in its precarious perch and whistled low and long.
"Lots of luck," he murmured.
Andrew seemed confused by what was going on next to the bank. Wasn't Hanover going to take a drop and get on with it? A red-jacketed official jogged over to the site. He paused, looking at the edge of the water, and slowly nodded his head. Eric leaned over and whispered,
"They're saying he found the ball, but it's perched on some sort of grass ledge."
Andrew smiled. Even better. Hanover would try to hit it, and then knock it in the water. He might take the lead on this hole if Hanover's stupidity held.
"Are you going to hit it?" asked Paul.
"You know me," answered Scott. "I've never seen a lie I couldn't hit."
"I know you can hit it. Do you think it'll end up anywhere playable?"
"What are my options?" "None, really," interjected the official. "You must play the ball as you find it."
"Technically, it's over the edge of the water," said Paul. "He could take a drop."
"It has to be in the water," said the official. Then he paused and added, "I think."
"Doesn't matter," Scott said. "I'll give it a try."
"I wouldn't risk a practice swing," Paul said. "You could knock it off that grass with an easy puff of air."
"That's what I figured," agreed Scott. "What do you think, my pitching wedge?"
"How do you feel about your sand wedge?" asked Paul.
"Not good."
"Pitching wedge it is," said Paul.
He pulled the club from the bag and Scott took it carefully. The others stepped back as he gripped the club and wiggled the weighted shaft around, getting a feel for the club and trying to line it up in a path that would hit the ball. He aimed for the left side of the green, hopefully avoiding any water. But if he caught it on the toe, he was screwed. He was conscious to avoid twisting the club again like he did on his last shot.
"You can do it, Scott," shouted a voice from across the fairway. Scott knew at once that it was Sarah. He turned, shading his eyes to try to pick her out from the crowd. Her bulging stomach gave her away quickly. He smiled and waved and nodded his agreement.
"Go for it," shouted other voices in the crowd. "On the green."
"In the hole."
"Let her rip."
Officials started to hush the crowd, and Scott settled in to get ready again. He could do this. It was just hitting the ball with the right touch. Not too hard, not too soft. An easy partial backswing, and just keep your eye on the ball, he told himself. He imagined Andrew Patterson smug with the knowledge that Scott's self-destruction had begun. He couldn't let that stand. He pulled the club a little bit above parallel to the ground and whispered, "Please," as he aimed for the clump of grass. The air exploded into a puff of grass blades as he swung. The clutter distracted his eyes from the ball.
"Where did it go?"
he asked Paul.
"Straight up," he answered, staring at the sky.
"Wow," he commented once more.
Alf Redding was following the little speck, and it seemed to stay aloft for a very long time.
"It might make the green," added Paul.
The ball whistled down and, with a splunk, plopped onto the longer cut fringe that surrounded the green. Scott let his breath out. He still had 5 or 6 yards to the hole, but he was out of danger. What a shot.
"That was just amazing," commented Jason Bernard. "That ball seemed too scared to come down in the water, as if Hanover would never forgive it if it got even the slightest bit wet. But based on what we've seen from this young amateur so far today, it really isn't all that surprising."
The crowd applauded with enthusiasm, and Andrew turned and looked at the people around him, thinking, why are they all applauding? Couldn't they see how lucky that shot was? There was no skill. He just whacked at the grass and got lucky. He could just have easily ended up in the pond. He shook his head and started walking to the green. Scott looked down at the bank. A few shattered stems remained where the ball had been a few seconds earlier. He shook his head in disbelief. If you can't be good, be lucky, said Paul, hopefully not for the last time today. Scott turned and waved at Sarah. She was jumping and clapping and hooting with the rest of the crowd. Boy, was he glad she was here. He noticed that Ellie's camera was looking at him, and he smiled and waved at her, punching the air with the satisfaction of a great shot. The image flashed across television screens all over Chicago and several other cities. None of the people knew or ever heard of Scott Hanover before. He was just an average guy, having an above-average day. And the excitement was enough to get people who didn't even golf to watch the television. Those who did golf were awed by his performance. He was turning sow's ears into silk purses left and right, and giving Andrew Patterson, top Chicago amateur, a run for his money. Andrew approached the green. Don't do anything stupid, he told himself. He knew there was a great tendency for golfers who were a little behind to take risks and push themselves to catch up. He reminded himself he had a game plan, and Hanover didn't. He needed patience. Hanover couldn't keep up this show forever. The game was Andrew's to win. Scott was up first, as technically his ball wasn't even on the green yet. Paul handed him the putter, and they looked over the lie. You'll need to give it a little more than you think to get through this fringe, he cautioned. I figured. I just don't want to leave it short. I can smell a par. Patterson could be looking at birdie, said Paul. I'll still be ahead, added Scott. He lined up his feet for the putt. Putting on the fringe was not as exact a science as putting on the green. When you were on the green, you could usually count on a fairly consistent surface. It was easier to judge the speed of the ball and how hard to hit it. On the fringe, the grass was cut a fraction of an inch higher. While it didn't look that much different, it could really slow the ball down to start. And then the transition from the somewhat taller grass to the closely cropped green could change the direction of one's putt significantly. Scott took a couple of practice putts, adding a little more force to the swing than he thought necessary, then stepped up to the ball. This time, there was extreme silence as he stood ready to take his shot. He kept telling himself not to leave it short, especially not 2 or 3 yards short. He drew back the club, mimicking the force of the practice swing, and pushed the club head through the ball. He hit it hard enough that it jumped off the grass a little, rather than just rolling. After a foot of the fringe, it hit green and continued going. It wasn't headed straight for the hole, but it would be close. For a minute, it looked like maybe he had hit it way too hard, and it would roll well past the hole. He hadn't noticed the crowd was now cheering the ball on. One guy, perhaps the same one who had yelled it before, shouted, "It's in the hole!" As the ball drew nearer to the hole, the cheers grew louder, and then an amazing thing happened. The ball made a tiny break, a minute shift in its direction following an unseen contour in the ground that he had missed. Its change in bearing took it straight for the hole, and even before it plopped into the black opening, the crowd erupted in wild cheers. Oh my God, Scott said to himself. He had another birdie, and was now 8 strokes under par.
An incredible putt, commented Jason Bernard. I'm sure it surprised him as much as anyone else. The pressure is now on Andrew Patterson to make his putt so that Scott Hanover's lead does not get larger. At this pace, Hanover is set to tie the record for the best 18 holes for the PGA.
The last fact was courtesy of Freddy from the studio.
Actually, since Hanover was hitting from the fringe, that stroke won't count as a putt. So far he hasn't had anything higher than a one putt on any hole, and three holes with no putts. He's averaging less than 3/4 of a putt per hole.
Jason was pretty impressed with that last statistic from Freddy. What was it going to take to stop this guy? Hopefully nothing. On screen held a close-up of Patterson's face. Bob switched to that camera. Here, of course, is the most surprised person. I'm sure he was counting on picking up a stroke or two here, but Hanover's luck on the front nine seems to be spilling over to the back. Joe Calkin stood on the far side of the green. Hanover was making some incredible shots, doing things he didn't think were possible. How Scott got the ball off that grass hanging over the water was a miracle on its own. Ted Lang nodded slowly to himself. He mentally calculated and extrapolated Hanover's score if he kept up this pace. He had never seen anything like this before, and wondered if his little talk with him this morning at the driving range had anything to do with it. Part of him knew the pendulum could swing at any moment. This could quite easily be the end of his incredible run. Even if it was, he was glad he was here to see this much. Andrew Patterson took his putter and waited for the crowd to quiet down. He couldn't let the lucky putt get to him. He had to play his game. He would come out ahead. He would be happy with the par on this hole. That was what he planned on, and that was what he was shooting for. There was no point in making a mistake now. The last bit of cheers from around the hole quieted, and he stepped up to his ball, eyeing the path he had imagined on the green, mentally calculating how hard to hit the ball.
"In the hole, fancy pants!"
yelled a voice from the back of the green. Several people around the heckler shushed him. Andrew chuckled at the comment. That was a new one. He lined up his club head again, tracing his imaginary line across the white inlay on the top of the putter head. He drew back and hit the ball. It rolled up to the rim, hesitated a split second, and then plopped into the cup. Cheers erupted again, and quite unintentionally, Andrew raised his putter in the air and yelled, "Yes!" He quickly regained his composure and took a deep breath. There was no need to get excited. A birdie is a possibility on every hole where one made the green in regulation. It wasn't something to count on, and he didn't. Why wouldn't this guy implode already? Wasn't the crowd enough to give him nerves? Then he realized Hanover had messed up, but a lucky shot had saved him. What were the odds that the ball would find the only outcropping of grass to save it from falling in the water? Hanover's luck couldn't hold. It wouldn't. He reached in and pulled his ball out, handing both it and the putter to Eric, who had just returned the pin back in the hole. Jake Fisher shook his head in disbelief as the television replayed Scott Hanover's last two shots. This guy should be playing on the Pro Tour. Well, maybe not. He knew Scott's handicap was 18. He was having a good day. He hoped that he would let him parlay it into some cash for a college fund for his soon-to-be-born child, or maybe let him and Sarah fix up their house, or take a nice vacation after the baby was born. It wouldn't hurt his pocket either. For the last year, Jake had burned his savings and was beginning to build up a pretty sizable credit card debt. Gina had been forced to pay dinner tabs more than once, and he hated putting her in that position. A thwacking sound in the background suddenly got significantly louder, and Jake watched a small helicopter land a couple hundred yards away on the now empty driving range. The force from the blades was enough to send balls rolling away in a circular path around the base of the helicopter, so when it landed, the grass was clear. Two people got out, a man and a woman. The woman looked familiar. He squinted and his jaw dropped in disbelief. The two ducked under the spinning blades and jogged for the cover of the shack, where golfers got range balls and were quickly out of view. April.
Thank you for listening to A Really Good Day, a novel by James Hosek, narrated by Rich Hosek. If you're interested in purchasing a hardcover edition of this story for yourself or a golfer in your life, visit jimbooks.myshopify.com. You'll get free shipping in the United States. You'll also get the complete audiobook and ebook editions with your purchase. And make sure to subscribe to the mailing list for updates about the upcoming release of his Doctor at Mystery series, Cozy Mysteries about a Crime-Solving Veterinarian. Thanks again, and all the very best.